You guys, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books was nominated for a Webby Award, which is this really prestigious award that I am dying to win. And there's a People's Voice component, and you can vote and get me from number two, second place, to first place. But you have to vote. Please go to vote.webbys.com. Vote.webbys.com, but it's kind of complicated, so it might be easier just to go to zibbyowens.com or my Instagram at zibbyowens, where it'll always be in my stories and it's in one of those little circle highlights. Please, please, please vote. Voting ends April 18th and I'm in second place, so please vote for best individual episode, talk show, interview show. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Today's episode has been sponsored by Jay McLachlan. Jay McLachlan is a timeless lifestyle brand with incredible style and a spirit of connection. I am obsessed with Jay McLachlan and have been so honored that they are sponsoring my Zibbyverse tour. It just so happens that the tour goes to so many communities and areas of the country that have Jay McLachlan stores. And I love that the brand is philanthropic through Jay McLachlan's local and loyal programming. Host store events to give back to organizations that are meaningful to Jay McLachlan's local communities. I also love the fact that the clothes are just so chic. They make me feel polished and modern, and the best part is that most of the line comes in fabrics that don't wrinkle. I especially love the dresses, the cashmere sweaters, the other sweaters. You'll see them all over my Instagram. I typically tag at Jay McLachlan, and so you can check it out. It is absolutely one of my favorite brands, and I am over the moon excited to be working with them. In fact, I want to share the love with all of you. Jay McLachlan is giving 20% off new customers and listeners of my podcast with special code ZIBBY20, capital ZIBBY 20. That's 20% off for new customers and listeners of the podcast with special code capital ZIBBY20. Take advantage of it today. My favorites are this white, open, long cashmere sweater that I've been wearing on every flight that I've taken on this tour. I have a blue with light blue horizontal striped sweater, several dresses I even wore on Good Morning America. Check it out, Jay McLachlan. Thanks so much.
Hi, I'm Zibby Owens, and you're listening to the award-winning podcast, Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. If you like this podcast, you will love my new anthology called Moms Don't Have Time to Have Kids. Check it out, and you'll hear from 49 authors about all sorts of things moms don't have time to do. All the authors have been on this podcast. Also, check out my TikTok, at With Zibby and Tracy, my other podcast, Sex Talk with Zibby and Tracy. Check out Moms Don't Have Time to Write on Medium. And of course, my new publishing company called Zibby Books. And now back to our daily author interview site and a quick hello from some of my kids.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello. Enjoy the show.
Happy New Year, everyone. I hope you all had a great break. I wanted to let you know about something that I've been talking a lot about on social media at Zibby Owens, which is the hashtag 22in22 challenge. We are at Zibby Books. We are encouraging everybody, like all of you, to visit 22 bookstores in 2022. And we're going to provide a whole series of incentives for every 5 visits, and you'll be entered to win a $500 shopping spree, and you'll get fun things like bookmarks and all the rest. Plus, you'll be part of a great community of people all helping support bookstores, authors, and more. We're really, really excited about it. If you want to join, sign up. You just go to 22in22.net. That's 22in22.net and click I'm in and put your information. And then every time you go to a bookstore, you just quickly go back on the site and click log a bookstore visit. And then we'll be keeping track and we'll be following up with all of your different achievements and awards and everything. So please sign up, spread the word. 22 and 22, get your friends to join and start visiting bookstores, and it'll be really fun and exciting. So here's to a wonderful 2022. I'm so excited that you're listening to my podcast and doing all the fun things that I have been trying to bring into the world. So here we go, 2022, hashtag 22 and 22. Jacqueline Friedland is the author of He Gets That From Me, a novel. Jacqueline is the author of the award-winning novels Trouble the Water and That's Not a Thing. She holds a BA from the University of Pennsylvania and a JD from NYU Law School. She practiced as an attorney in New York for a hot second before transitioning to writing full-time. She lives in New York with her husband, four children, and two very bossy dogs. Welcome, Jackie. Thank you so much for coming on Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books to discuss He Gets That From Me.
Hi, Zivi. Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
It's so neat. I actually was talking to Kyle because I was reading your book and he was like, wait, I remember when we first met her and she was talking about how she was working on this book and here it is. So I don't know, I feel like some sort of investment that we've seen this, you know, come to fruition. So it's exciting.
For sure. It is. It's a long process though. I actually just yesterday was a guest speaker for a high school literary club. And they were asking me about the process to publication. And they were all flabbergasted that they're like, wait, it takes that long. It takes that long to write a book. And then it's another year or 2 years before it comes out or 3 years. They couldn't digest this at all. But I told them it's good to be patient. It's a good lesson in patience, putting books out into the world.
Yes, very, very true. Okay. Can you tell listeners what your book is about, please?
Sure. It is the story of a young woman who serves as a surrogate mother only to discover 10 years after the fact that she accidentally gave away her own biological child.
And how did you come up with this?
So I was working on a different book and it was in very beginning stages and I was procrastinating like you do and reading. I don't even remember what publication. I think it might've been People Magazine online. And I saw an article about a woman who, an American woman, who served as a surrogate for a couple from China. And she was supposed to deliver twin babies who were going to be the genetic offspring of this Chinese couple. And when the twins were born, one of the babies looked like the Chinese parents and the other baby appeared to be black, like the surrogate's husband. So, you know, all parties involved kind of scratched their heads, but still sent both babies home with this Chinese couple. And I guess, you know, over the next month, everybody kind of wised up to the fact that like they should investigate. And it took them a month to figure it out and to figure out that the surrogate had actually gotten pregnant. She had been implanted with embryos and they thought that two had attached, but it turned out only one of the embryos took. And then when she was cleared to have intercourse with her husband, she got pregnant again, you know, the natural way. And so the first thing I was like, wait, but if she was already pregnant, how'd she get pregnant again?
Right.
So I'm, you know, immediately on Google and looking this up. And it turns out that this is actually something that happens. It's a thing that women who are pregnant can get pregnant again. It's just so incredibly rare that nobody ever tells you about it. It's called superfetation and it's a real thing. And they actually think that a lot of fraternal twins may have been conceived this way and that there's just not really a need to delve into the, you know, to do all that testing on the pregnant mothers to figure out if, you know, they might have a week difference or that in their gestational age or, you know, what, but it explains a lot like why one twin is often much bigger than the other and things like that. But so I went on Google, found all this out, and then I was just so floored by the entire thing that it really just stayed on my mind. And I got to thinking, you know, what if the families had been the same race? And then they might not have realized, you know, that something was amiss. And what if it had been, you know, what if something happened 10 years later where they found out? And then what do you do when you discover you have a child that you had no idea was out there? And do you take it back? Do you not? And so immediately I was like, I have to write this story. That's how the book came about.
Wow. I love how that's how novelists think.
that when, you know, all the what ifs, instead of just being like, okay, yeah, what if, and leaving it at that, it's like, well, now I have to write a novel about it.
They say, you know, that novelists have they have more fear in general in life and anxiety because they go to every what if and they play out every possible scenario. So, you know, the minute you put me on an airplane, I'm a disaster because I imagine immediately all these terrible, crazy things. And
me too. I'm like immediately like at my memorial service and like, yeah, I've gone the whole route. Who would be left? How would they find out? Like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. What if this plane? What if that plane? What if on the way back? Yeah. What if, da, da, da. Yeah, I'm like the queen. This, I think, is why I like love what I do, because every day I talk to people who like share my anxiety and it's like amazing. It's like,
yeah. You know, I'm like drafting my eulogy to send to my sister. I'm like, read this at my funeral, you know, sending it from the plane.
Yeah, exactly. I know. I'm like, well, should I book the place or should I give my list of spots? And, you know, I don't know. Anyway, yes. So the what ifs of the world. But yes, so I thought it was really interesting the way this plot sort of evolved, right? And how it slowly manifested, especially from the point of view of a gay couple, and how when they found out, when, so for a lot of gay couples who have twins, it's often the case that one is from one guy's sperm and one is from the other. And so they both feel like vested interest biologically in their kids. And so one of the ramifications of finding this out in your book was that one dad ends up not having a biological child and the other dad does. And so he feels sort of alone in that grief, because essentially he's just lost what he thought was like the continuation of his DNA and his offspring and all of that. So tell me a little bit about that piece of the puzzle. I found that really interesting.
So, you know, first of all, when I was researching the book, I learned so much about third party assisted reproduction and all of the different ways that couples and families can be built. And there's apparently, you know, if you have two women who want to raise children together, oftentimes they will take the egg from one woman and fertilize it outside of her body and then implant it in the other woman so the other one carries the pregnancy, and then they're both equally, you know, vested and they can both feel like the mother of this child. And there's so many different scenarios like that and different ways that families figure out to include different people and, you know, have everyone be a part of it. But there's also, you know, there's adoption where nobody was involved in the pregnancy. And it got me just to thinking, you know, we as parents project so much onto our children and believe so deeply that, you know, this trait they got from me, this one they got from their dad, this is from their grandmother. And we think we know our kids so well. And, you know, but then you think about like your own parents and how well they think they know you and how much you may think they're wrong. And I really sort of wanted to play on this idea that, you know, the nature versus nurture question may be different than anything that, you know, we've ever thought about. And the way you build a family may be different than anything that we've ever thought about. And so when one dad has a son that he can say, this child is biologically mine, he projects certain ideas onto that child. And when the other dad finds out that neither child is biologically his, he sort of has to question everything and really look into, well, what is it to be a father? And what is it to have a child? And how independent of me is my child, or should he be? And I really just wanted to play with all of those questions. So that's kind of how it came about.
And the impact between the siblings, which becomes like a really big thing, you know, like how do they feel themselves, right? Because all these paternity and issues that arise, you always are thinking, you go straight to the parents, right? But even at age 10, they have their own feelings. 10 years is a long time. I mean,
yes, yes. Yeah. When I started drafting the book, my entire perspective was really about Kai, the boy who, you know, is genetically not related to the father that he thought he was. And I was looking at it from, you know, what has Kai missed? He has missed 10 years with his biological parents. He has missed 10 years with a biological sibling, with his grandparents, and all with his religion, with his, you know, all sorts of heritage. As I got deeper into the draft, I sort of realized, wait a minute, it's not only Kai who's missed it, it's the parents and the grandparents and the siblings. And, you know, it's sort of like, and maybe Kai didn't miss anything because he got something else, mm-hmm. where everybody else, there's just sort of a hole where Kai should have been. So, you know, in that regard, I think also the sibling relationship, was an interesting way to play with it. Because if you think about, like, some siblings get, especially twins, you know, can really rely on each other and really get close, and in a way that that is very different from the parent-child relationship. And so, you know, I think there's a loyalty that often exists between siblings that is really, is unique. And when somebody sort of like attacks your relationship with your sibling, you almost get more protected than you ever would vis-a-vis like a parent relationship. So for me, and also I, you know, when you write a book, they tell you write what you know. And, you know, I've never had a child through surrogacy, but I know I have four kids of my own. So parenting is something I know. And the idea of, you know, having my biological children in my house versus somewhere across the country where I never knew they were was something that I could really sort of imagine and play with. And I also have a sibling who I, you know, a sister who's a couple years older, who has been such a, you know, a force in my life. And so I could play on that and, you know, imagine what it would be if somebody told me, actually, you guys aren't related. And so it was interesting, actually, as I've been getting reviews and feedback on the book, a lot of people have said, you know, as a gay dad, this book resonated with me. As a parent, this book resonated with me. All sorts of things like that. But what really meant the most to me was one person contacted me through my website and told me that her daughter, who's in college, read the book, and she's a twin. And that it really, she just was so struck by the book and, you know, the looking at the twin relationship and how important it is to twins to have that relationship and that identity. And then when you sort of not attack it, it becomes how heart-wrenching it is. So that was a very interesting facet of the book for me.
Wow. I have twins. I don't know how they would feel. I don't know. They'd probably both be like, okay, you go. You can go to that family. I'll take this family. How old are your kids now, by the way?
I have 17-year-old, 15, 13, and almost 11.
Wow. And what genders are they?
Three boys. And then my youngest is a girl. And my oldest just got into college, and it has completely adjusted my entire perspective on parenting. Everybody says, you know, it goes by in a blink. And all of a sudden I've really realized he's leaving. And so I've been nicer to all of my children and like, spend time with me, give me an extra hug. You know, all of a sudden it's hitting me.
I feel like I went through that early when my son went to boarding school at a very young age, and I like mourned that. So yes, I feel like by the time he goes to college, I'll just be like, all right, see you later. But no, yes, of course it does. It's crazy. I mean, to be honest, the fact that my son can now like walk around the city by himself and it's like not a big deal, like all of a sudden, that's been like the biggest shock to me. I'm like, okay,
you're very hard to
decide where you go.
Yep. I mean, that's something I think about. So my oldest can drive now and he'll go out and, you know, he sort of tells me where he's going. I have a general idea, but there's this letting go that's really difficult. And he was getting his license as I was finishing this book. And I was, you know, there's a scene in the book where Maggie, the woman who served as a surrogate, she's in New York and she has left her son with a friend in Arizona. And she calls up her friend to say, you know, how's Wyatt? Do you need me? What's happening? And the friend says, he's fine. He doesn't need you. He's fine. Go do your stuff. He doesn't need you. And when they hang up the phone, he doesn't need you really resonates with Maggie. And she's like, wait a minute. You know, does anybody need me? And do we as parents need our kids more than they need us? Mm-hmm. And that's actually something that as I'm watching my own kids kind of get grown and flown a little, I'm really thinking about, you know, it's the same joke you hear about, you know, adults go out to dinner with their friends and show pictures of their kids, but you know, their kids aren't out showing off pictures of their parents, you know? Yeah. So it's an adjustment letting go. I will say that.
I loved Grown and Flown, the website, by the way. Do you want to read those essays? Oh my gosh. Maridel and Lisa and the book too. The collection of essays. I feel like that might have been 2 years ago I had them on for that book, but those should come up like every year.
They should. I think it's like, it should be required reading.
Yes, it should. Here is what to expect when you're expecting, and let's jump ahead to when they leave and that is survive 18 years. Oh my goodness. So when you saw the article in People and you're like, I have to write this novel, what did you do next? Like what happened and did you outline the whole thing? Like, and then how long did it all take? Like, what did that whole thing look like?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This message is sponsored by Greenlight. As kids get older, some things about parenting can get easier. I mean, not many, but some. But others don't, like having conversations about money. Point is, kids won't really know how to manage their money unless they're actually in charge of it, and that is where Greenlight can help. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. Parents can send money to their kids and keep an eye on their kids' spending and saving, while kids and teens build money confidence and lifelong financial literacy skills. With the Greenlight app, kids can learn how to save, invest, and spend wisely, thanks to games that teach money skills in a fun and accessible way. I got Greenlight debit cards for my kids. The greatest thing, you can actually add their photos that take up half the card. So when I handed the cards to the kids, they were like, this is so exciting. So they look great. Unfortunately, I only put the required 2 cents on at the beginning to make sure they worked. So the kids were like, well, what should I spend my 2 cents on? Anyway, millions of parents and kids are learning about money on Greenlight. It's the easy, convenient way for parents to raise financially smart kids and families to navigate life together. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/Zibby. That's greenlight.com/Zibby to try Greenlight for free. Greenlight.com/Zibby.
So I knew the first thing I had to do was research because, you know, I wanted to really get it right with surrogacy. I think that the fact that surrogacy exists is a wonderful thing for so many people. And I didn't want to write the book in a way that might dissuade anyone from ever pursuing surrogacy as an option for their family. And I also just didn't want to get anything wrong because I feel like as an author, you have a responsibility when you're sort of introducing a concept to people who might not be familiar with it or writing, you know, historical fiction, whatever it may be. People think they're learning when they're reading your book. So you have this responsibility to kind of get it as right as you can. So the first thing I did, I happened to have a friend who had a baby through surrogacy and her child is now 17. So when she did it, it was less common than it is today. But she's a very close friend of my family. And so when she did it, and as she's been raising her daughter, I've sort of had a front row seat. So she was very generous and, you know, spoke to me at length about it. And then from there, I met with a woman who runs a surrogacy agency called Growing Generations. And she was so enthusiastic about the concept for the book. And she put me in touch with other people who work at her agency who just she specifically chose one woman in particular who served as a surrogate herself 3 times. And this woman then put me in touch with other people who served as surrogates. So I really spoke to a lot of people who've gone through the process. It's been much easier, you know, like where I live, I think there is a geographic component. And where I live, there are many more people who have used surrogates than who have actually served as surrogates. The only people that I have been in sort of like my social circle or my demographic area who I might interact with who've served as surrogates usually do it for someone they know. But the people who just do it, you know, getting paid have sort of, they're more like in the Midwest and more geographically spread out for me. But the good news is they're really, for the most part, very happy to talk about it. These women who serve as surrogates, for the most part, are these, like, you can't believe how giving and generous they are. They don't do it for the money, and the agencies won't accept women who they believe are doing it only for the money. They do it because they really feel, you know, how important it is to people to have children and that they, you know, for whatever reason have an easy time being pregnant, they enjoy it, whatever it is, and they just want to give, you know, in some way to other families. And there are people who've done it three, four times, you know, after they've had three or four kids of their own. And it's sort of, I mean, it's astounding that these, like, putting up with the pregnancy and then, you know, and then giving away the child that they've been carrying for 9 months. And then when they actually collect the payment, it's really, they use it for things that you would be surprised sort of how, like, frivolous they are. Like, they'll go to Disney World, or they'll buy, like, a little, like, some new furniture for their living room or whatever it is. Like, they really view the money as kind of bonus money. So that was a very interesting part of, like, learning that was very interesting for me. And also just getting to talk to all these people who are so giving was kind of exciting and fun. And then, you know, I spoke to doctors, like fertility specialists. I spoke to attorneys in the different states where the characters go, because in each state in the country, the surrogacy laws are different. So I needed to talk to people in New York. I needed to talk to people in Arizona, where the book kind of starts out. And then I also, you know, spoke to people in Arizona. So there was, and then, you know, was there any, I mean, and then I spoke to parents who have adopted. I spoke to same-sex couples who have, like, you know, looked at all the options and decided not to have children. There's been, you know, it sort of runs the gamut, but it was a lot of fun to talk to all these different people and also to find the common threads in what they would tell me. So that was the bulk of it.
Wow. And where do you like to do your writing?
I do everything at home. I always thought before I actually started writing full time, that I would be one of those writers who, like, goes to a coffee shop and makes friends with everyone who works there and has my standard table. I can't. The minute I go into a public place, I'm so fascinated by the world around me, especially the people, really. I don't care about the other stuff. But the minute someone walks into a store, I'm like, oh, what's she doing? What's she getting? Who's she getting? And heaven forbid, I can't make sense, like, oh, that's obviously, like, a husband and wife, or obviously, like, a mother and son. If I see, like, you know, a guy who's in his 40s and with a guy who's in his 20s, I'm like, is that an uncle and a nephew? Is it a, like, I immediately, I'm like building a new story about these people. So,
I mean, is it a job interview?
Exactly.
Maybe, they work together. They used to work together.
And then maybe it's a college interview. And then
right. College interview. That's not on my, like, menu of options.
Yep. Could be anything. So,
you're right.
I stay home, which is generally great for me. It was a little harder during COVID when the height of lockdown, when my husband, who I share an at-home office was here every single day. And I discovered that 95% of his job is talking on the phone really loudly. But I developed a system. I put the earbuds in and I actually started listening. I started with classical music. It wasn't working for me. Lyrics distract me. So I ended up listening to classical Scottish music, which is mostly bagpipes. And it's now this, like, Pavlovian response. When I hear bagpipes, I get in the zone right away and I'm, like, writing away. So, but he's back in his office now. So I only have bagpipes twice a week when he works from home.
That is so funny. You would rather be listening to bagpipes blaring away than your husband chatting. Okay. Well, whatever. Great. I'm glad you found a way out of that. That's so funny. And how about now? What are you working on?
So I'm at the tail end of another historical fiction novel. I have this bad habit of switching from genre to genre when I write, and I can't seem to stop myself, but I find these stories and I get very, you know, one track mind, like, this is the story I want to tell. And when my first book was historical fiction, my next two were contemporary fiction. But when I was researching for the first historical fiction, I stumbled on a story about a runaway slave, a true story, and these two Northern abolitionists who helped this man. And it's a fascinating story that was a national sensation at the time that it occurred. This guy was, you know, a household name, and these two abolitionists, Anne and Wendell Phillips, really did so much for the abolitionist cause. And most people don't know anything about them, and they're really interesting. And I had to tell the story, and that's what I've been working on.
Wow.
Yes. I was especially excited about it because Anne, the wife, was an incredibly influential abolitionist. And as a female at the time in which she was living, she sort of had to do all of her work through her husband. So it's an interesting story. And that was super fun to research. And almost everything included in the book is, like, true history, down to, you know, the eclipse that happened on a particular date or the newspaper articles that are quoted. So it's been a fun project for me.
And I know you have this, like, tight-knit group of fellow authors. When did that come about? And, like, when did you consider yourself an author, and how did And what's like the importance of the author community to you?
So I think many authors would say they're still, you know, they could publish 12 books and still not consider themselves an author. That there's always this like imposter syndrome fear in the background. But I would say I got comfortable saying I was an author after my first book was published and, you know, out there in the world. One thing when I was a kid and trying to figure out my career and, you know, would in passing say to my mother, you know, maybe I want to be a writer. And she would tell me, you know, that sounds lovely, but, you know, it's so much time by yourself and it's really isolating and you should think about that because you, you know, really like to be with people. And before I was a writer, I was a lawyer. And I have to say that I have made so many more friends as a writer than I ever made as a lawyer. The lawyer job I found very isolating and, you know, antisocial, but it's been incredible to be a part of this author community. I have found that the authors that I come across, everybody is so supportive. There's none of this, you know, competition. And if your book sells, mine doesn't kind of idea. I think if anybody's book succeeds, the book industry as a whole is succeeding, and that's good for all of us. And I think there's an understanding of how hard it is to put your book out there, to put yourself out there, to take these risks. And so everyone is so supportive of each other in that way also. And I remember before my first book came out, I went to hear a historical fiction panel and I just happened to, you know, I just introduced myself to the authors who were on the panel. And then there was somebody's publicist was there and the publicist, who, you know, was not my publicist, was like, oh, you've got to meet this person who is a bookstagrammer and this one who's another author. And by the end of the night, I had 10 friends, you know, and it's like every day I feel the community is growing and it's really nice. And I'm actually just about to start a new writing group with a couple of authors who I've, you know, just met through going to things and being with people. And I love the writer life.
That's great. It's true. You can, I mean, people A are so nice and B willing to help. And yes, I mean, there's this misconception. That's so sweet your mom said that, because that's something my mom would totally say to me, you know, like worrying about the things.
Yeah.
That they perceive. But I feel like when I'm writing, I don't know. I don't ever feel alone when I'm doing it. Like it's like some other thing. It's like, you don't worry about feeling alone when you're like in a yoga class or something. You know, right. Like, or I don't know. It's like a different something.
It's almost self-care. It's like, yeah, inside your head and sorting through your thoughts. And I agree. And
it's like, I'm worried about you feeling alone because you've been doing so much running.
Right.
Right. Like, yes. You're like, no, of course you're alone, but you're, you know, you're listening to music and you're doing this and like, it's good for you. And, you know, you're not really alone. I mean, even if you're at home on a treadmill, like, I don't know.
No, I agree with you. I think it's therapeutic on some level. And, you know, I find it's almost like, you know, charging your cell phone. If that's how I am when I write, when I get up from the computer and go back out into the world, I have much more energy than I did before, you know, spending that time by myself and recharging like that. So, but, you know, I think it's funny, you know, the other thing my mom has said that I keep talking about recently is, you know, one of the main catalysts in the book for everybody figuring out that there's a genetic situation that may have arisen is that the two dads and their sons decide to do like a 23andMe kind of a genetic test. And so everybody keeps asking me, have I done a 23andMe? And I have not, because my mother has asked me not to.
And what?
So I'm like, wait a minute. If I didn't look so much like both of my parents, I would be really freaked out by this. But she doesn't want me to have my system, the systems to have my information out there. She's concerned that, you know, first she's like, I don't really, you know, the government will know you're Jewish. I'm like, I think that cat's out of the bag. Second, you know, it's bad for identity theft, whatever it may be. So I have, my father did a test and he's 99.9% Eastern European Ashkenazi Jew, which was no surprise. They actually contacted
him. As am I, by the way.
They contacted him like a year, he did it like years ago, and they contacted him after they had sort of like refined their equipment. And I guess they had new information and told him that he was 1% Irish. And I'm like, I knew it. I've always loved Ireland so much. It's sort of, you know, you take me back to the bagpipes, which is not exactly because Scotland, but then they contacted him a year later and they said, no, it was a mistake. He's still just Ashkenazi Jewish.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there are other guys out there who look kind of like your dad.
Could be.
You know,
it's been funny. I've been in some Facebook groups where I've been like talking with readers. And if I ask the question, have you ever done a DNA test? And did you find out any surprises? One after another, the comments are, you know, I discovered my dad was really my uncle, or my brother was my father, or what. Well, I mean, the craziest stories. And that's just in these little Facebook groups with, you know, like 1,000 members or whatever it may be. So there must be so many people out there who have discovered crazy things. So, you know, I think it's great for people who like that information. And for me, I've decided to follow my mom's advice and decide that ignorance is bliss, you know?
All right. Well, I don't know. That could be a memoir for you. Let's see what happens.
For sure.
Close to the vest. Okay. Last question. Any advice for aspiring authors?
Yes. I think the most important thing is to write as much as you can and not wait for the best idea you've ever had or the thing that you know is going to work, and just sit your butt in the chair and get words on the page, because once the words are down, you can edit, you can revise. And sometimes just in the way that like talking with a friend may give you an idea and help you think of something, actually putting words on the page may make you think of something that has nothing to do with the words you're writing that, you know, inspires a whole different story. So I think, you know, if you're not writing, you can't call yourself a writer. So you got to sit down and write.
All right. Noted. All right. Awesome. Jackie, thank you. I really enjoyed your book. I loved the characters. The pacing was great. It like moved so quickly and you just kept wanting to like turn the page and figure out what was going to happen. And I was debating what I thought I would want to do in that scenario. Anyway, it made you think and feel and all the good things. So yeah, it was really great.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Okay. All right. I hope to see you soon. Okay.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Don't forget to follow me on Instagram at Zibby Owens and at Moms Don't Have Time to Read Books. Also sign up for my newsletter at ZibbyOwens.com and sign up for my virtual book club and meet lots of authors on Zoom every other week. Thanks so much to Steve and Ryan at Texture Sound for the sound editing. And thank you to Morning Moon Productions for providing this fantastic intro and outro music.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.